say that he felt like a frog from a different pond in a conference at IAS, and I guess I feel the same here. You will hear different type of talks from the ones you heard today, and I learned a lot being here this couple of days, because this is definitely not the type of mathematics that I usually do, so I hope you will learn something from what I get to say now. I will start by writing a nonlinear Schrödinger initial value problem, and this is IUT plus Laplacian of U, plus here I will put rho. Rho is a real number. The importance of rho is that it could be positive or negative. It doesn't matter really the size. And then I have a nonlinearity equals 0. P is, for now, let's take greater than 0, but I will specify later more precisely. And I assign initial data U0. So the question I want to ask is very simple. The dimension here for now is n, but obviously I will be more specific later. So the question is the following. When can you claim that given a smooth initial data, there is a classical solution for that equation for all time? All times is the important keyword. So the question is, when do you have classical long time unique solution, obviously for that initial value problem? Well, it's not an easy question, and I will try to convince you of that fact, but let me first tell you when you can say something in general. The first thing that it's a number. The important p is the power of the nonlinearity. Rho is just a constant. What will be important about rho is the sign, not really how big it is. This is not for me. For physicists, this is completely this, but for this particular question. So the first point that I want to make that is the following. If the initial data is small, and when I say small, for me, means small in a subwaller space. So if this is small enough, then the answer is yes. You can have so. And why is that, that you can have classical long-time solution? The reason being that if k is large enough and you are looking at solution in the class hk, the subwaller space hk, then the non-linearity really, you can think of being able to bound the infinity norm of each u, if it is in this class, by subwaller theorem. So the nonlinearity is really small. So you are really thinking of the nonlinearity like a little perturbation of the free Schrödinger, which obviously can be solved by transforming it into an ODE with free time. So that's the first remark. The second remark is that if large data, well, then you have to, in general, I'm talking in general terms here, then you have to restrict the size of the time in which you can claim that there is a solution. So you can prove in general there exists, not all the time, but let's say in general you can prove that exists a unique solution, but for small time, or short time, whatever. So these are the kind of situation that you encounter in general. So,
Sorry, one more.
Yes.
There probably other physicists here who also, like me, don't know what Sobolev space is.
Sobolev spaces means that if you take the function, all derivatives up to order k, they are in L2. You can also define through the Fourier transform with the weight, which is 1 plus the c to the power k, that being time the Fourier transform. That's for us a way of measuring how smooth a function is. Okay, so let me tell you immediately that that problem there has, for any p, two conservation laws. The first one is the L2 norm, second one is what I call energy, and the energy is 1/2 the gradient of U squared. And then here I have to be careful with the sign minus rho over 2p plus 2, and then U to the 2p plus 2 is all in dx. And this is also conserved, meaning stays the same for all times. Okay, so now you understand immediately what is the, why I was stressing the fact that rho could be positive or negative. Obviously, if rho is negative, then E is indeed an energy. So these norms are bounded by the total energy. So E is an energy. As a consequence of this, the gradient of U in L2 and the L 2p plus 2 norm are bounded for all time. That's the point. And this is an a priori fact. And if rho is positive, well, then there can be competition between these two things, and in particular for negative signs of the energy, but also actually the energy equals zero. Blow up has been proved for certain values, so PM will not be specific on that, so blow up, meaning that the gradient of U of T in L2 goes to infinity in finite time. I will not tell you when, for which P this happens and which dimension, but in general we do not expect a classical solution when you are in this situation. Another thing that I wanted to mention is that the equation has a very natural scaling, meaning if you solve NLS, that problem, then this other U, which I call U lambda XT, which is U lambda to the, to give you the power, 1 over P, U lambda X lambda square P, also a solution with initial data U0 lambda X, which is U0 lambda X. Okay, so this rescaling, it's important for the following fact. If you look at the norm in the Sobolev space, homogeneous means that I'm not really looking at the L2 norm, I'm looking at all the derivatives of it. Actually, I want to take Sobolev for any S, not necessarily the natural numbers. Then you get the following calculation, which is simple. S plus 1 over P minus N over 2, N being the dimension, P being the measure of the nonlinearity, and then U0 in H dot S. So that's the way the initial data is scaled. So this number and the sign of it determines when the NLS is critical, subcritical, supercritical. So subcritical, maybe many of you heard that the Navier Stokes is well, it depends if you talk to fluid people or not, but the Navier Stokes in L2 is what I will tell you here, a supercritical problem. And that's why it's a million-dollar problem. So that just to give you an idea where we are in this type of situation. So subcritical means that S1 plus P minus H over N over 2 is positive. So that's a subcritical situation. The critical means that this number is zero, and the supercritical means that 1 to P minus N over 2 is negative. So why is this is in order of increased difficulties. This is kind of doable. This is hard, and this is I don't see of any problems that have been solved in the supercritical regime. So why is this doable and this is hard, it is so much more. This is the following. Because when you let lambda go to zero, then you make this rescaled initial data. Think about having an initial data here. This initial data shrink, small. So you kind of fall back into the small data regime. And also, the important thing is that when you lambda tends to zero, the space in which you are solving the problem, the time in which you are solving the problem becomes long. So this is something that it's a sort of an easier regime. When it's critical, noise scaling allows you to shrink the initial data, so you cannot do anything like that. And, well, we'll talk a little bit more about, but just to give you an idea, if you know about that, the critical wave equation was solved not too long ago, well, maybe 10 years ago, and what I will talk about today is the critical Schrödinger equation. Okay. So by criticality, obviously, means in what space. I had to talk about the S there. All right, so it depends what norm you wanted to think about being critical. For example, the L2 norm is critical for cubic 2D NLS. Cubic means that the P is 1. This completely open. There is no meaning, if you assume that your initial data is in L2, there is no theorem that tells you that you have a global solution. On the other hand, H1 is subcritical for this problem. And in fact, you can prove that you have a global solution if you start in H1. So in particular, if your initial data has even more regularity, then the solution maintains the regularity. So the answer to that question is yes, again. Okay? But that's because in this two-dimension, three cubic, the H1 is subcritical. So now let's go to three dimension. So 3D. Well, in 3D, P equals 2. So that means quintic H1 is critical.
So by H1, you mean that grad U is...
Yeah, L2.
Is
L2. Well, that's what I assume. That's my, in fact, actually now you say. For example, let's do the following. Let me ask you the following question. Assume that you have that problem in three dimension with P equals 2. So it's the cubic. H1 is critical. And let me tell you that you start with an H1 data that has this finite. Do you have a global solution? That was not known until a few months ago. So that's what I will talk about. So in the two-dimensional case, cubic, that was known. But on the other hand, the H1 norm, which is related to this, is not critical there. It's subcritical. And for the kind of informal discussion I was having, I was giving you before, that's an easier problem. And that was known. On the other hand, the L2 part, so if you only start with this, which is a natural starting point for this problem, because that's preserved. If you only start with that, it's not known whether or not the solution exists for all time. You only know it exists for a small interval time, which depends also on the profile of the function. Yeah, that's exactly what we talk about now. Okay, so this is the problem I will... I need to rewrite it again because I will be talking about this a lot. So UT plus Laplacian of U, and then I said that I would talk about the defocusing case. Let me just write this. And for U0, finite. That's the problem. You want to know whether or not that's solvable for all time. Okay. So let me tell you what was known about that problem. So what was known about this was the following. The first thing that was known is, if you assume that U0, let me be a little bit more general, is in H1. In particular, the AU0 will be finite. But moreover, XU0 is in L2. So somehow you are telling me that at infinity it decreases faster than it would if you're just in this space. Then global exists, global unique solution. But this is not part of the energy that I wrote there. So it's an extra condition you give it to it. Another thing that was known, and then that I will actually write into a theorem, for I'm going to call it theorem zero, because I will generalize this in a little while, is the following. If, let's write this way, EU zero is small enough, so that's a small energy type of result, then there is unique global solution. For this solution, let me call it U. For this solution, you know that if continuous with respect to, oh, this, by the way, is a reversible problem. So if you go forward, you go backwards as well. So, well, let me write H1. But also, besides maintaining the regularity you started with, it has a bound which is uniform in time and in space. And that's an L10 bound. So that's something more. You might think that this is a kind of a strange thing to ask. But believe it or not, this allows you to tell you to claim that as t tends to infinity, this solution becomes like a solution to the free Schrödinger. So it is a very important fact to have this norm over here. So as a consequence of this, moreover, there exist two different solutions to the free NLS. I mean, the free Schrödinger equation, such that as you let the difference, well, let me put this, you measure this in H1 dot, this goes to zero as t tends to plus or minus infinity depending on this. So this is called scattering, as you very well know. So that's a very nice theorem, but it's still a small data theorem. So in 1999, Bourguin, and I'm glad it was mentioned before today, proved the following. It proved theorem zero without smallness, but, so, minus smallness, but plus radial symmetry. And a little bit later, Grylakis proved a weaker version of that theorem. It just proved yes to that question, meaning a classic existence uniqueness to global classical solution. Also assuming radial symmetry assumption. Okay, so that's Grylakis' result. I should mention that Grylakis is also the person who proved basically that theorem without the smallness for the critical wave equation. Generalizing a result of Struve and Chatin. Now, the theorem that, let me call it one, that it's in collaboration with Colliander, Kiel, Takaoka, and Tao, we are known as the Gang of Five, but these are the people. We proved theorem zero without any other assumption. Just assume E of U zero finite, then same as theorem zero. And moreover, I didn't write over here, but also, if moreover you assume that U zero is in HK, then the solution is in HK. And this answers the question I wrote at the very let me write H dot, doesn't matter anyway, H. That answered the question that I wrote at the very beginning. So that settles the situation. Okay, how much time do I have? Ah, thank you. No, less than zero. cannot be because I'm not defocusing. Sorry, I mean finite. All right, so I'm not able to tell you a lot about the truth because obviously I don't have much time, but I will just tell you one fundamental part. So the proof for Bourdain goes basically in the following way. What we use from Bourdain proofs was in particular the philosophy that he presented in the proof. So this kind of theorem, you cannot prove it by fixed point theorem because it's not a perturbation of the linear problem. So there's nothing like a fixed point or an iteration or anything like that. So what he did was the following. It's basically by an induction on the size of the energy. So obviously, if the energy of the initial data is small, then okay. That was the theorem here. So now let's assume that, what is the next step of induction? If E of U0 is less than a certain E minus mu, then this implies that E of U0, maybe I should say in a better way. So if you know that, what you had to prove as a next step is that if you know that the theorem is true in this condition, let me call it theorem zero, you want to prove that also true. Okay, that's how the induction goes. Okay, so to prove this step, he does the following. So he says, well, assume, I should mention that to prove the theorem, you can reduce everything in proving that L10 bound. So assume L10 bound, not true. Then he's able to show that there is sometimes t0, there is a certain ball centered at the origin and a certain radius r, such that the gradient of u at time t0 on this measuring the L2 norm on this ball is big. Bigger than epsilon. So it carries with it, has inside some energy. So then, if at that time you think of splitting, you think this as an initial data, and you split it into ut0 inside the ball, ut0 outside the ball, then you evolve this as the NLS. Now, this is okay because the part A that I wrote up there, because you are inside the ball, okay for all time. On the other hand, this guy, when it evolves, has an energy which is like that. So okay, although you cannot evolve with NLS because this is not a linear problem, but it's a different NLS. But never mind, it's very similar to NLS. So this goes through okay. So I'm sorry to have reduced Bourdain's beautiful proof from these two lines, but that's how it goes. Now, what he used in the main point of the proof, which is that the gradient stays above zero in a small ball, is a Moravec's type of inequality, which looks like this. Let me write it with the correct numbers. An interval I, okay. This is less or equal than the soup. Okay, that's what he used. This is a Moravec inequality. Now, the fact that there is this weight here forces him to reduce the situation to radial symmetry, and this fix is important. But in any case, the thing to observe is that here you have a subcritical norm, a supercritical norm in this regime, so you have to do some work to do that. Now, in the case of the proof of Grillakis and Chata and Struve, there was a similar type of inequality, that's the wave situation, but on the left-hand side, you wouldn't see appearing a critical norm, supercritical norm, so it was a much easier situation. Now, in our case, the whole story the we felt that we could prove the theorem when we found the following sort of Morawitz inequality. Now, I will write it in the following way. So, the integral over I, number 3, utx, or dx, dt, less or equal than u0, l2, sup, ut, 1/2 squared. So, this is a new type of Morawitz inequality that had not been used or found before a couple of years ago. Now, I have to say that there is a lot of limit. It's not that when you found this, okay, now I can use the whole, I can just prove the theorem because I have some sort of a priori bound in time and space, in space and time, which is important. This has a lot of things that go wrong. For example, this is more supercritical than this one because you see the L2 here. It's not very good. So I don't have time to go at all into the proof. But let's say that we start believing that we could do it when we notice that, at least to remove the radial asymmetry, when we notice that we could get something without this weight on the bottom. Now, this is not as strong as that because there is an L4 instead of an L6. Again, there is the fact that it is much more supercritical than this guy is. But working a lot in looking at the worst situation that could happen, that could prevent that L tenome from being bounded, we reduced to ourselves to consider only the situation in which U is localized both in space and frequency. Localization changes in time, but it's localized. Once it's localized in space and frequency, something like this with the localization in space and frequency of this guy can be proved, although that localization does not satisfy anymore the original equation factor with the Schrödinger equation like this one. So you have to work very hard because you cannot prove that that localization obviously solves this problem. So there are a lot of problems going on. And another ingredient that we put in the proof, beside the usual Strieker's inequality and the sort of perturbation theorems which are more standard, is what we called almost conservational L2 norm that we have been using to prove many results in going from local well-posing to global well-posing when you do not have a priori estimates in the way that I wrote over there. So I'll stop here, and Jim is here, and I will leave it tomorrow. So if, unfortunately, if you have more questions about this, I guess I can delegate Jim in answering them. Thank you.